once I see that the device works properly, it release me.
I very much doubt it. You see, before you reactivated it, I reversed the polarity of the neutron flow.
You realize what will happen?
Oh, yes. Do you? Well, I've reversed the polarity of the neutron flow, so the TARDIS should be free of the force field now.
So he's reversed the polarity! Keep back!
All right, yo ho ho, my hearties, and welcome to another episode of Reversing Polarity, where we set sail on the high seas of classic Doctor Who and find all of that queerness, which I know lots about, you know, sodomy and the pirate tradition.
My waveform is fucking awful.
Oh god, so it's mine. Hello, arr. I'm A. My pronouns are they, them.
Arr, Ivy Rosie, and you can... I can't do it. I'm they, them. I was trying to come up with a pirate joke. Like, what's a pirate's favourite pronoun? And I couldn't think of one. Oh no, the seven she.
Job, brilliant.
So based on those fantastic clues, I wonder if any of our listeners can guess that this week we watched The Pirate Planet by Douglas Adams,
which had less pirates than I expected or wanted, but was still a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. It was like, it was going to be either that or The Space Pirates, which apparently nobody likes, so
I'm sure we will experience it at some point.
Yeah, so did you have any prior knowledge of this one?
Yes, it was one of the ones that we watched last summer. Ooh. When we were just randomly watching episodes, and the visuals really stuck with me. The plot didn't, but the visuals did.
That's fair. So I love the model. Had you seen it? I had not seen it before. As we've discussed many times on the podcast, I was a Tom Baker contrarian. I think this serial, five serials in, I'm finally starting to get it.
Oh, he was on top of his game.
Yeah, it's a really good one. I think I've seen very short bits of it, because I recognize, like, you know, the guy, the captain, I recognize him from like clips, but I've never seen...
Must have shown up in some like compilation video of the wildest classic Who villains.
Yeah, all the fan vids I spent all my teens watching, probably in there somewhere.
That's a time.
Yeah. Some of them are really good. But no, as I say, I hadn't seen it. I love Douglas Adams, so I was very pleased to watch one that he had entirely written, and it was great. So no complaints from me.
Yeah, likewise, I absolutely love it. I think the Baker Adams pairing just works. They get each other and what they're trying to do in a way that's really conducive to some fun TV.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, what's the ranking of most to least Adamsy Doctor?
Ooh, five doesn't seem very Adamsy.
No, I think six is up there, and two.
Six is very much up there. Seven's like a midpoint. Seven is late Adams.
Yeah, seven's late Adams. Three is like Dirk Gently, but the Netflix show.
Which I love.
We do love the Netflix Dirk Gently. Yeah. This is a fourth Doctor serial, as we mentioned. It is our second part of the Key to Time sex trilogy. What would it be?
There are five? Six of them?
Hexology? There's six of them.
Serial?
Hexilogy. A series of six. What would it be? Because there's a quadrilogy is four. A quintet is five.
Hexology.
I said it. I did it.
You did. Your knowledge of Greek astounds me.
Is that Greek? Oh my god. Uh-huh. I just always assumed that we didn't call it a sexagon because it would sound rude. But no, it's Greek. The Pirate Planet. I'm just so pleased with this. So, the Doctor and Romana 1 learn the second segment of the Key to Time is on the planet Calufrax, or is it? Yet they arrive on a planet called Zanuck, which has been hollowed out and fitted with hyperspace engines, allowing its insane half-robot captain to materialize it around smaller planets and plunder their resources. Excellent premise. Excellent premise.
It's such a fun setup as well. The confusion and...
The mystery.
The half... Yes.
Because they don't reveal this whole hollow planet thing until, like, halfway through episode two, yeah.
Yeah, it sets up a very good mystery, and it's, yeah. Shall we climb the riggings of the recap?
Sorry. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm so on my bullshit right now. This is great.
We can go out to the playground with the PE teacher, and we can play Captain's Coming.
So, episode one starts on a mountain base.
Woo!
With the
model shots!
Mr.
Model shots! Model shots!
The models are beautiful little polystyrene models.
It's so good. Like, city. It's the model of the clay city that's like, wow, this looks like a papier-mâché project that a year three did in an amazing way. And then jutting out from it are these three black cylinders with 100 million windows. And you're like, ooh, that looks weird and manufactured and incongruous. What could it be? And the answer is it's an evil base. Perfect.
Who could have guessed? So on this mountain base, the nervous Mr. Fibulae informs the impatient captain that a new source has been found for Vasilium. Immediate orders to mine it follow. The captain speaks to the people of the planet, declaring a new golden age, and the people cheer half-heartedly.
The seven people who live on the planet.
Hey, it's very populous.
Sorry, it's just they don't even bother to like fake it being populous by zooming in. It's literally just a square, and then there's seven people in it, and an eighth person wanders off. it's amazing.
It's very good. As the people celebrate, a different group dressed in yellow robes mentally watch Pralix, who doesn't appear as thrilled with the captain's announcement as everybody else.
Oh, Pralix. He's very gaunt. He's kind of Pralix, got a Richard E. Grant vibe.
Ooh, I was seeing more like a young Colin Morgan.
Yeah, kind of a mixture.
Meanwhile, in the TARDIS, the Fourth Doctor is securing the first segment of the Peak of Time by tucking it into a boot and sticking it in the fridge, because of course he is.
Yeah, where would be safer? Where would be the last place you look? In the fridge, and then in the boot that's in the fridge.
Yeah, it was the sort of joke of, how do you fit four elephants in a mini? You shove them in. How do you know if you've got four elephants in the fridge if a mini's parked outside? the tracer points Romana One and him to the cold and boring planet of Calyrax.
Indeed.
The TARDIS is unable to materialise, damaging Xanax engines as well, until Romana pilots it into a landing.
Perfect.
It's perfect.
Just the whole, like, it starts off, they're just bickering over how to properly fly the TARDIS, because she's like, well, I was never taught these Type 40 things. Vintage and...
Vintage models.
Vintage and veteran models was an opera... was an opera... And optional course. And then what was it she studied instead? Because you loved it.
The Gallifreyan Flutterwing, which is evidently much more useful.
She's a xenolepidopterist. And that's all there
she's
is.
She's brilliant.
It's great. And she's like, you know, she's put the TARDIS manual on this beautiful lectern. And she's talking about all the things he's supposed to be doing as he launches. And he goes over and just rips a page out of it. Beginning, just a general... perfect comic timing in this serial. It's perfect comic timing. Everything that is supposed to be funny is so funny. Like,
and everything sort of just carries on so nicely.
Yeah.
From the setup of their relationship and the story before.
Yeah.
But you're seeing that they're slightly more comfortable with their bickering and they're settling into this rhythm, and I love it.
Yeah, it's very fun. I'm really coming to love Romana One. And I'm sad we only get six serials with her beautiful face. And her extreme disinterest in people attempting to be misogynist.
She's very powerful.
She is. Also, just so I don't forget, I love the name Calyphrax. I think it's great.
I think it's a like semi-reference to something in Hitchhikers.
Yeah, I feel like just all...
Salyphrax?
Like, yeah, Douglas Adams just has this incredible facility for naming things. Like, Zaphod Beeblebrox, are you kidding me? That's the best name ever.
Powerful.
Ulan Kalufid, it's all good.
I am nodding.
Also, Romana One in this, her behaviour where she's, you know, being cool and in charge, I was like, man, I need to reread Hitchhikers just for Trillian. I miss Trillian.
Oh my god, what a fantastic character.
I'll reread it someday. I know the TV series is on BritBox, I should get on that.
Okay. Meanwhile, Pralix is now delirious, watched over by his grandfather Balatin, sister Mula, and friend Kimbus.
Friend.
Balatin is... Friend.
Sorry, I'm grasping at those straws. I'm grasping tight.
It's something that we know how to do.
Indeed.
Indeed. So it's like a reflex. There's like an inch given and a mile taken.
Yes. And we deserve that mile. We deserve it so much.
And then some. We deserve the country mile. Mm-hmm. Balatin is concerned that his rantings will be overheard. The area in which the Doctor and his entourage have landed, good job TARDIS Wiki, is deserted until they meet a local who tells them that the people of his planet are going to be rich because of the captain and his latest golden age of prosperity. He gives Romana some diamonds and rubies, saying they can be found everywhere. He warns the Doctor about her and the Mentiads, then leaves before he can elaborate. The Doctor finds precious stones all around, including the extremely rare Ulian.
The setup for this scene is also extremely funny, because the Doctor is trying to talk to people, and no one will listen to him. And Romana's like, let me have a try. And she wanders off, and he and K-9 conference about it. And K-9's like, she is much prettier than you, Master.
And people are more interested in talking to her.
Yeah, she's wearing this beautiful, like, pink silk blouse over her white jumpsuit. Amazing. Of course you want to talk to her.
Pristine white heeled boots. Yes. It's an outfit I wouldn't even dare to pull off, and there are very few of those.
It's so good. Like,
very good.
Kind of a Penelope Pitstop vibe in the best way.
Ooh, oh my god, it is.
If anyone's listening doesn't know who that is, she's the one from Wacky Races.
Or Lady Penelope from Thunderbirds. Yeah. Same sort of
just
aesthetic.
Women that wear pink and are cool.
And called Penelope.
Yes, and called Penelope. God. We need to stop mentioning Thunderbirds because I really am just going to marathon it.
Nothing's stopping you. There's a bank holiday tomorrow. Live your best
That's
life.
That's true. And then Tuesday I have the day off because it's my birthday.
Hey, happy birthday.
Thank you. It's going to be good. I'm going to try and get everyone to listen to the podcast as a present.
Amazing. Incredible.
No, I was going to say, I love this whole precious gems thing because it really sets up that the people don't really care about the actual results of the prosperity. Like, they're leaving these gems littered all over the floor. They just need that rush from the announcement of prosperity, and then the captain just gets to keep all of the proper minerals that he likes. Not Ulian, apparently, which, despite being very rare, is probably not actually very useful.
I wonder if that's partly because it's not usable as currency, or because they have so much of it, it diminishes in value as soon as they have such a large possession of it.
Yeah.
So what once was rare is then common and not worth as much, so it becomes pebbles.
It's like that whole thing about how there are actually a lot of diamonds, but they use forced scarcity so that people have to pay lots of money for them.
And now they just have cultural value status.
Yes. Man. It's almost like capital is a lie.
Is the economy fake?
Yes. The economy is a story we've been telling ourselves. I just like it. And also, like, the bit where they're just holding up this insane, like, egg-shaped, like, Fabergé egg crystal of Ulian. And they're like, wow, how beautiful. It's just a big green egg. It's great.
It's great. They got all of the gems from, like, a wholesaler who did costume jewellery.
That makes
sense.
So
they bulk bought a bunch of stuff and used them a lot. Balaton is terrified that Praalix will be taken by the Mentiads. Kimis is sceptical, and Moola remembers her father's death at the hands of the captain's guards, ostensibly to save him from the Mentiads. Meanwhile, the Mentiads declare their harvest of Praalix is imminent, which is a terrible phrase, and I do not like it. As they march across the fields of Zanuck, the Doctor hears Praalix and sets off to investigate. Romana waits behind, surveying the captain's fortress with a telescope, only to be arrested for that forbidden item and her forbidden question. Why?
It's great. And then and then she says, no, K-9, you mustn't. And the guard's like, what? She's like, no, K-9, you mustn't fetch the Doctor. It's good. And K-9 is like, mistress? And then trundles off. Every time we see K-9, I fall more in love with him. I already loved K-9 so much.
He's a perfect dog.
And now it's like he's saying things about piece of cake, and like he's being good, and he's saying that he is friend, and you're like, yes, you are friend, K-9. He is the most friend-shaped anything has ever been.
Apart from maybe Kirby.
I don't know.
Kirby is shaped like a friend.
Kirby is shaped like a friend, but K-9 is shaped like a friend despite his angularity, which I think makes it more impressive.
Very true.
Like, you'd have to put a cushion on K-9 to give him a proper cuddle, or you would end up with bruises. I just love him. I don't know why. I just love him so much.
He also has, like, the delivery in his voice is just so earnest as well, which is one of my favourite character traits.
It's exactly how a dog would talk. Master! Yes. Master!
Affirmative.
I successfully laserified the guards. Like, oh my god, that's my little boy. And I know that Tom Baker fucking hated him, so it's kind of funny when he's like, you're my best friend, K-9.
You're my best fucking friend, you bastard. K-9 deserves better than Tom Baker's hate.
He does.
So he can have our love.
He can. We love you, K-9. All marks. All marks of K-9.
Every single K-9. The captain sends more of his soldiers to stop the Mentiads, but weapons are useless against their psychic powers. Instead, the captain sends troops to find the telepath and eliminate him before the Mentiads find them first. They burst in on the doctor in Pralix's home, but K-9 quickly stuns them.
Yes.
Good boy. The Mentiads enter soon after and strike down the doctor with a blast of mental energy.
So good. The whole...
It's a really solid first episode.
The effects are so good.
It also sets up a lot of questions and doesn't answer any of them.
Yeah, because you're like, what the fuck is up with this guy? What are they mining? How are they finding new minerals? All this stuff. Like, I kind of knew what the premise was before. And if I hadn't been spoiled, I definitely would have been a little bit more intrigued by the mystery than I was. But it's really interesting. And, you know, it's just so fun. It's so funny and interesting and, like, things are moving.
It looks like everyone's having a good time making it as well,
yeah. Which
is always nice to see.
Episode 2. When the Doctor wakes, Pralix and the Mentiads are gone. K-9 tells him of Romana's arrest, giving him an incentive to try to get the bridge atop the mountain, where she has been taken by the guard. Kemos accompanies him, hoping to rescue Pralix from the Mentiads. They get up to the mountain in an air car. Meanwhile, Mula and K-9 track the Mentiads in an attempt to find Pralix. Yeah, last episode, when Romana is being driven away in the air car by the guard. Like, she's so dismissive of them the whole time. She's like, oh, I had one of these for my 70th birthday. It's so good.
It's incredibly good content.
Just
apparently the air cars are put in because Douglas Adams hated when they just had to run around corridors.
That's fair. It looks great.
Yeah.
He definitely didn't want them running around corridors this episode, because whenever they step into a corridor, it fucking propels them to the other end.
It's like a little travel agent.
It's so good. I have to confess, everything about this episode made me think of Magrathea, even though objectively it's not a lot like Magrathea in any way, except possibly the fact that it's hollow. Magrathea is the planet-building planet in Hitchhikers. It's where Slarty Bartfast is, and he makes Earth 2. I can't believe you wouldn't know the ancestral homeland of Slarty Bartfast.
I would have 10 years ago. My memory is broken.
That's fair.
I apologise for my sins.
I don't know why I've retained the name of Magrathea, and so many other things have slipped my mind. Like, you know, the names of children in the moment. Quite a lot of books that I've read that aren't Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. my best
Evidently
friend's
it was
birthday
very formative.
Every year. But yeah, and I quite like the discussion that they have before they head out, where Mula is like, I am going to go and find my brother Pralix. And the Doctor's like, yeah, you know what, fine. And sends K-9 to make sure she doesn't get, like phaser blasted out of existence.
Yeah.
She's great. There's a lot of good women in this one. I say a lot. There's three good women in this one.
There's three good women, but they're all very good women.
Yes, and to be fair, the balance isn't as egregious as in some other serials, because there's not a lot of characters. Yes, on the bridge, Fibulae breaks the news to the captain that the Macromat field integrator has burnt out and they cannot replace it themselves. He suggests one more jump to find mineral PGX-18, which would do the same job as the integrator. Yeah, they're calling all the minerals, like, designations, which I think is to I think is to create suspense of not knowing what it is. Because all the other ones they're calling, like, Bubberingdon 5 or whatever it was, and, you know, Ulian and stuff like that. And this one, they only have a designation.
I like Ulian.
Ulian is good. It makes me think about Ulan Kalufis and like Boolean numbers and stuff. It's fun. It's all very good sci-fi words, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah. Romana is brought to the bridge, and the Doctor also finds his way up.
as he does.
Yeah, it's Romana is in, and she's like, well, I'm only the Doctor's assistant. We have to go and find him. And they go find the Doctor. And then the Doctor waltzes in under the opening door and goes, hello, I'm the Doctor.
It's really fun.
Also in episode 1, Romana asks someone if they'd like a jelly baby, because she's already picked up on that habit.
And the Doctor's like, where do you get these? And she's like, same place as you, I stole them from your pocket. Very good.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. The captain isn't taking any chances. He has guns trained on them as he encourages them to lend technical assistance. Romana is confused that the tracer gives out a continuous signal wherever they go. The Doctor realizes what's going on. After they escape with Kemos and make their way underground, they find the ground beneath them is frozen. Yeah, because they're getting led out of the building so they can go and work on it. And then Kemos, who has been posted as a guard outside, shoots all of the guards, which works quite well. But yes, the Doctor explains the planet they are on, Zanak, has been hollowed out and fitted with engines so it can transmat through space and materialise around others, such as Calufrax, to plunder their mineral wealth. Very concept. Let's not think about how planets work. let's just not think about
it. Why would we need that information?
Why would we need to know how gravity works in this situation?
Maybe they've got a gravity simulator to counteract the lack of mass.
Maybe
of the
they all have glue on the bottom of their shoes. It doesn't matter.
It matters a lot.
I think it would be funny if one day we just, like, the Doctor goes to a planet and everyone else starts floating and she's just walking around and they're like, wait, how? And she's like, I've got glue on my shoes. but yes, so plundering the mineral wealth, and it's how this planet is continually going around, but they don't know why it's going to these particular places and why it needs these particular elements as of yet. The Doctor, Imana, and Kimus have no time to pause as the captain's guards give chase from behind. As they run, they face a group of Mentiads who say they have come for the Doctor. And that's the end of episode 2. Now, I think it's because, like, in a sense, not a lot happens, but it's also because the things that happen take a while in the best possible way. Yeah. Like, it's paced very well, and it's not overstuffed. And there's some great acting turns from the guy playing the captain.
Oh boy, how do you... Let's paint a word picture for our listeners.
Yes.
He's like a middle-aged man you'd see ranting in the pub. Except he's constantly cursing about the Sky Demon.
Yes, and he's a cyborg. He's like half...
He's a cyborg.
He's half Robocop, half Vernon Dursley.
Yeah, exactly.
And
he's got a little robot pigeon.
Yeah, it's a parrot.
A parrot.
He calls it a name that begins with Polly at one point, and I'm like, ah, I get it, Douglas Adams. I understood your joke.
I've noted that down. 1 second. A polyphase Avatron.
Yes. It's
so good.
A multi-moving bird bot. So good. I can't remember.
Doctor Who is a perfect show.
Yeah, I watched these first two episodes yesterday, so I don't remember them in great detail. But I remember, like, I got to the end of the second one and I stopped because I had to go to bed. But I was also like, man, I just want to watch the rest of it. It's just.
Yeah, I got to the end of it. I was like, oh, we've already got through the first two episodes?
Yeah, it's very pacey. Neat. And it's very fun. And it has enough humour and enough seriousness to make it. Like, the Doctor is very serious about the fact that this planet has been destroying other planets. Like, yes. They find all the remains of Calufrax underneath because Romana is like, it's cold and wet down here. Cold and wet? Calufrax!
Calufrax!
But yes, so the Mentiads say they've come for the Doctor, including Prelix. He has been taken by the Mentiads and turned into one.
Episode 3 starts with the revelation. The reveal? The revelation? That the Mentiads are friendly and have come to save the Doctor and his friends from the guards.
Yay!
The Mentiads, now including Pralex, create a force field with their psychic powers, which is very cool.
Zigzag, zigzag, zigzag.
It's kind of fun having psychics in Doctor Who.
Yeah, God, I love it. There was no mind hypnosis, powers are cool. But there is psychics.
Yeah.
Because I think that with the level of Time Lords being telepathic, I know that they play into it on varying levels. I kind of wanted more of the Doctor being explicitly telepathic because he does a bit of it in this, in episode 4.
Yeah,
but I just always want more of the Doctor's like alien stuff. You know, being an alien.
Yes, I think that's why Tom Baker was such a popular Doctor, because he is slightly exaggerated and slightly
he feels
alien-esque anyway. He does. He acts otherworldly.
Yeah.
But this power of the Mentiads creating the force field won't last much longer. Zanak has come to Calufrax for its crystals. When refined, they can be used to block their psychic abilities. The Doctor doesn't know it yet, but the Captain is planning to materialise Zanak around Earth after mining on Calufrax is finished, because the mineral PJX18, quartz, has been located there. I actually really like that as a way to up the stakes halfway through because of the viewer familiarity.
Yeah.
And especially with the Doctor having such a affection for Earth, it works really nicely.
Ooh, yeah, they're like, the planet Terra in the Sol system, and everyone watching is like, oh my god, it's Earth!
Oh my god, it's Earth!
Every sci-fi thing for the last 100 years is called Earth Terra!
In the Sol system.
Yes, in the Sol system, because nowhere else calls the sun. They all have the different words. I do, like, obviously this is never going to happen in Doctor Who. I have to wonder what the alien version of Proto-Indo-European would be like. Like, what do they call things?
Ooh.
I'm intrigued. This is this is why I cannot commit to a world building project, because I'll end up doing that instead.
I mean, Tolkien did it.
Yeah, I'm not.
He's a big old nerd.
I don't have a doctorate in medieval history or whatever it was that he was up to. Anglo-Saxon history? I don't know.
All I know is that when he was a tutor at the university, everyone else didn't like him because he used to skip his actual teaching so he could write Lord of the Rings.
Yes, I had heard about that.
Yeah, and I'm like, that fits. It's like that's
him and M.R. James, I think, are on opposite ends of the spectrum, because M.R. James was all about the teaching and all about the learning shit.
Yep, definitely. All right, where were we? Okay. The Mentiads tell the Doctor that Zanak was a prosperous planet until the reign of Queen Zanzia. He supposedly had mysterious powers. Ooh. Galactic wars she waged with the ruin of Zanak and its people.
Girl boss! Gaslight gatekeep girl boss! She did effectively utilize girl power by destroying Zanak's economy.
Tweet us with your thoughts.
Oh my god.
The Doctor and Kimmis fail to steal an air car and are taken to the bridge. Do you want to elaborate?
Oh no, I just think it's funny that they fail to steal the air car.
The captain shows the Doctor his trophy room of crushed remains of planets, and we get to see some angry Doctor.
Yes, it's so good.
Yep. Just this quiet rage that Vor occasionally brings in, and it's powerful.
Yeah. Let's see.
The Doctor's secret plan.
I found the bit in Chakotay. Thank you, Chakotay. Because the Doctor, he's talking to him about it, he says, it's the most brilliant piece of astro-gravitational engineering I've ever seen. The concept is simply staggering. Pointless, but staggering. And the captain says, I am gratified that you appreciate it. Or however he speaks. Appreciate it? Appreciate it? What? You commit mass destruction and murder on a scale that's almost inconceivable and you ask me to appreciate it? Just because you happen to have made a brilliantly conceived toy out of the mummified remains of planets. Ah, so good.
It's so perfectly put. I think it's also, again, that Adams Baker collaboration.
Yeah.
Of the words are right.
Yeah.
And the performance is intimidating.
Yeah, it's good. It kind of makes the alienness into something intimidating rather than something charming in that moment. It makes me think about, obviously, this is a completely different level of it, but it makes me think about Matt Smith as the Doctor comparatively.
Ooh.
Because I think he does really well the change between playful and very serious in the same way.
Yeah, he can do it with a snap of the finger, effectively, which is...
And there are other Doctors that are good at it, it's just that I think of Matt Smith when I particularly think of it.
This is actually one of my favourite things about the Doctor as a character, is different approaches to rage, but the rage always being present somewhere.
It's very good. It's very good. Yeah. Even so early on in 1 and 2, you still get it, like, with the two's...
Two, absolutely.
Two speech at the war game. Whenever we get to the war games...
Oh, can't wait to get to the war games.
Oh my god.
The 5-hour special talking about the war
games. Yes, a 5-hour miniseries.
We'll have to do, like, 3, like, parts to that one.
We'll just do one episode for each episode, and it'll be shorter. Like, half an hour for each episode.
And then we'll drop them all on the same day.
Our epic 10-part series on why the war games fucks.
It's so good. I'd also just like everyone to know that Jodie Whittaker has joined us in the studio and is watching me, so I feel like I'm being assessed in my podcasting skill.
Has she meowed at you yet?
No, she's looked at me. She's just... I've finally cleared my room, so there's more places she can sit.
Can you give her a little scritch from me?
I can't reach her. She's all the way up there.
Well, whenever you can, give her a scritch from me.
I'll pass it on. Yes, she's such a good cat. Anyway, the Doctor's secret plan is to break into the engine room, but while looking for it, Kimmis and he find a room with an old body connected to a time dam used to keep Zanzia barely alive. It's so... such a good reveal. I enjoy it a lot.
All of the energy that they're acquiring through all these different minerals is used solely to keep the time dam active. Because it's like, she has 3 seconds left of being alive. They're keeping her alive for some reason, and we're about to find out why.
Yeah. Fun fact, the actress playing the old Zanzia insisted that they pay her an extra fee if they wanted her to take her false teeth out.
That's valid.
It's powerful. The Doctor returns to the bridge and exposes the captain's nurse as a hologram controlled by Queen Zanzia. The Queen believes that she has made her hologram nearly real. The Doctor tries to convince her that the escalating energy needs of the time dam she is using will eventually cause her real body to die. The Doctor is made to walk a plank suspended over a sheer drop. Then the captain fires a gun at his feet until the Doctor loses his balance and falls. The captain laughs.
Very good ending. I swear the hologram thing is not until episode 4. They don't reveal that she's a hologram until episode 4, because that's the whole point, is that he reveals...
That's true, yes.
I don't know TARDIS Wiki. I'm not sure about this one. I did watch it today. This cliffhanger is so fun, but so poorly framed by the camera. Like...
Yep.
It's just kind of a mid shot of the Doctor about 10 feet away on the end of a plank that you can barely see. And then he falls off it, but you can't even really tell because it's so far away from the camera. Zoom in! Zoom in!
Yeah.
But it is great.
I also really enjoyed... Yeah, I enjoyed this episode in terms of, like, keeping things moving. And
yeah,
again, it went by quickly.
Yeah, and it reveals the reality of the stakes behind it, which is that this is why they're doing this. And what happens is that they crush the remains of the planets into these singularities that then... Well, not singularities, but, like, super concentrated situations that are kept in these gravity wells. And then if any of them are out of alignment, it goes pop and creates the size of a planet in a very small room.
It makes me think, like, it's a very literal interpretation of the power vacuums will always be filled by the same power.
Elaborate.
So the idea that if a leader, for whatever reason, is suddenly ejected from their seat or leaves, and they will be replaced by somebody with the same values, stakes, and power, meaning that any change to the status quo is minimal, if it exists at all.
Yeah. So by the
fact that she's still alive and still effectively, like, puppet ruling in a way.
I mean, it's interesting because, like, in Kinder we had the old woman whose name I don't remember. Her spirit passes into a younger girl, but it's considered like more of an inheritance, whereas in this case, because it's a hologram, it feels more like cheating.
I also think that in Kinder it's done very organically.
Yeah,
it feels quite
it's an expected part of the life.
It's expected
process.
Part of life. Yep exactly.
Jinx.
Whereas this is artificial. I think also that the temperances of both characters are kind of opposite.
Yeah.
Like a quiet power versus an exploitative
power. Yeah, I just wanted to point out the comparison in the sense that they aren't really comparable because one character is good and one is bad. But I thought it was an interesting thing to have both of them be like, woman passes spirit to other woman, except one of them is young girl, one of them is hologram, not real. Yeah, so the reveal for episode 4 to begin with, since we've already talked about the hologram. The Doctor has survived because it was only a projection of him that walked the plank. Amazing.
Gasp.
He turns up from the other side of the room and is like, actually, I'm quite fine, thank you.
He is powerful.
Yeah, so he figures out the thing about the hologram and he tries to turn her off, but it doesn't work because she's like nearly finished the transfer. She's nearly powerful enough to be fully corporeal. But yes, so he's figured out the final pieces of Queen Zanzia's puzzle, the device he found in the room with the body. She's been disguised as the captain's nurse the whole time. The captain's nurse is a character who's sort of been around and has been quite, you know, confident and forceful and instructs the captain on what he needs to do and etc. Zanzia is almost immortal because of the power of Zanuck, which she uses to give permanent form to her image. The Mentiads approach the bridge. They expect the Doctor to have taken control of the engine room by now, but because of the psychic interference transmitter, they are disadvantaged. The captain seals the bridge as Zanuck prepares to make the jump to Earth. So here, they're like, we've got 10 minutes before we blow up Earth. The Doctor and Romana are attempting to figure out how the fuck to stop them from materializing around the Earth.
With
10 minutes to go, yeah.
It's a good bit of tension.
Yeah, there's a lot of technobabble about... Like this bit about the gravity wells and stuff. I'm going to try and find it because it was extremely confusing. Oh, yeah, and the canine has been shooting at the door to the engine room and he's exhausted himself and has to go and get plugged in, and it's so cute.
It's very sad.
His voice slows down and, oh.
He's just like, I'm out of energy. Can you do this for me, canine?
Yeah.
No, I cannot.
Somewhere around here we have the bit where... They talk about how the Doctor introduced Newton to the idea of gravity of dinner. And one, Isaac Newton was gay. Two, dinner, quotation marks. We have to accept. Yep. We have to accept that.
It's just fact.
Yeah, God. Yeah, so the energy needed by the time dams... the energy needs of the time dams increase exponentially, and there isn't enough energy in the universe for them to keep going forever. Yes, okay, hang on. I'm going to continue reading it, and then I found the bit where they do the insane technobabble for a bit. But yeah, so since Zanuck's engines were damaged when the planet materialized in the same place as the TARDIS, the Doctor escapes and tries to employ the trick again to prevent Zanuck from materializing, while the Mentiads do their best to sabotage Zanuck's engines. Zanzia kills the captain, who is saddened when Mr. Fibulae dies and finally turns against her. It's cute.
No.
It's
gay.
Yeah, it is. The Doctor, Romana, and the Mentiads destroy Zanuck's bridge and Queen Zanzia, ending the devastation caused by Zanuck's travels. This is around the point where they're trying to figure out what, like, the captain is up to versus Zanzia and what they're going to be doing with it. So the captain has a plan to destroy Zanzia. And Romana says, the only way the captain could destroy Zanzia without blowing himself and this whole mountain to atoms would be to get inside the perimeter of the time dams without disturbing it, which would require astronomic energy sources, which are all of the crushed up planets. So when he has enough of them, all he has to do is alter the balance slightly and create a standing vortex in the middle of the time field so time starts up at the normal speed and the queen dies. What?
I'm a little bit in love with your Mary Tam impression.
It's not a very good impression, but I know that she has quite a mannered approach to how she speaks.
She's apparently originally from Yorkshire has a very northern accent.
I wish
had
we
put
had
this on. They had to like change up some of her
honestly.
I would die.
Like now we're getting better with having companions with accents, and the Doctor gets to have a northern accent, and you're like, please more. Please
yes more. They had to like change various lines because there are some words that her accent would just slip through.
Yeah, I love that. But no, I've already said this, but her voice is so sexy. It's like
it is
this beautiful, like mellow, detached tone. Like she's so superior to everyone, and it's so hot.
Yeah, it's
God.
There's a confidence there that I just can't get over.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. Anyone who doesn't love Romana One is wrong.
Please come and fight us, but we'll win.
Yes. In the aftermath, the Doctor and Romana collect the second segment of the Key to Time, the remains of Calufrex. They set off back to the TARDIS to search for the next segment. So it turns out that the entire planet of Calufrex was the second segment of the Key to Time.
Which is insane.
It is. It is insane, yeah. Yeah, apparently it gets flooded. God, okay. So here's how they solve the issue.
This is the bit that went like over my head a little bit.
So... the Doctor switched the captain's circuits around to create a hyperspatial force shield around the shrunken planets. Then I put his dematerialization control into remote mode so we can operate them from here. Precisely. And then he says, what?
Please do audiobooks.
Well, first I dematerialize the TARDIS, then I make Zanuck dematerialize for a millisecond or two, then I invert the gravity field of a hyperspatial force shield and drop the shrunken planets into the hollow center of Zanuck. Exactly. What then? Well, I would have thought that was perfectly obvious. They expand in an instant to fill a hollow space and bang! It's so good. And then Calufrex apparently gets flung off into the space-time vortex and they just pick it up in the TARDIS, which is insane.
I think the story must have been pitched pre-Key to Time and then they had to, like, shoehorn it in at the
end
there.
And it's fantastic. And then there's the bit where Romana's like, but Doctor, haven't you forgotten something? What about the bridge and the time dams? Britain time, canine... Piece of cake, master. Blow them up. And you're like, yes!
Yes!
Oh my god. Canine with a... Doctor Who if Canine had a gun. Like, honestly.
I mean, he kind of has his laser
thing. He kind
of
has a gun, but like, he doesn't have a gun in the way that those memes have a gun.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then they literally, like, the Mentiads all team together mentally to press down the plunger on the detonator, and they blow up
the
model.
Good.
It's so good. End of serial.
To remain in this universe, the creature would have to reverse its polarity.
Amazing. I loved it.
It's wild. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. It's very well paced. This was one that the BBC head of drama wasn't fond of, and I don't know why. I enjoy it. Fight me, whichever Graham you are. Before we jump into things, can I actually just share one of my favourite things on TARDIS Wiki?
Please tell.
So on the homepage, it's got a bunch of information. There's a little segment called How to Doctor Who. Imitated by the long history of Doctor Who? Don't be. Just jump right in at this year's first story and enjoy it as a brand new show. These are the four concepts. These four concepts are probably all you'll actually need. The TARDIS. Sonic screwdriver. Friends. Regeneration. I just love the concept of friends. Let's continue with the show.
That's valid. Sorry, I'm having a look. I'm having a look in the book. It's a bit confusing because they sort of mix together various different serials. The page after, they mentioned that Graham McDonald said, on the basis of the first two scripts, this won't do. We're doing science fiction, remember, not comic cuts. The captain with the parrot is a cod figure out of Treasure Island with jokey lines which will inevitably lead Tom to stop taking himself seriously again. Like... and then the creature from the pit.
I mean, he wasn't taking himself seriously anyway. No, I don't think anybody could have intervened.
And then they talk about how the Star Wars factor impacted upon Doctor Who, because this would have been made just before Star Wars, right? 77, which is interesting because in a way the aesthetic is sort of Star Wars-y, I would say, like the.
I mean, the houses design, yeah, and the
and
costumes.
And Fibuli's outfit definitely is very imperial. So I guess it's drawing from the same sources, right? And especially because they were filming Star Wars in England. They probably had similar crew.
Yep.
But yeah, it's... Ugh, what a great serial. Like, just... Especially coming from the Rybos operation, or Rebos operation. Which is, like, fun, but it's not good. And it's not always fun. This one is like, they expand the scope enough that you're like, oh, okay, even though they obviously have like the same budget and the same number of cast members, they just decide to film outside and you're like, oh my god, grass. I love this. Look at this little like parish fields that they've gone to film in.
It's delightful. Somewhere in Wales.
It's so good. Somewhere in Wales.
An apple a day keeps the, No, never mind.
Let's talk about our boy, the scarf-wearing man. Although he only wore the scarf for a bit. At the beginning, he wasn't wearing the scarf, and I was like, is that a different outfit? No, it's just that the scarf overpowers.
The scarf's not
literally
there.
Overpowering. He is great in this serial. Like, he's just...
He's on form. It's brilliant.
Like, every line delivery is just so well judged, and you're like, oh, there he is. There he is. It's the Doctor. He's doing his thing. Like...
It's obviously the Doctor. There's no... Nothing is out of place.
Yeah. And as I've mentioned, this is like the serial where I finally start to get why everyone loves Tom Baker. Like, I really liked him. I think he's very good. But I didn't get it. And now I'm watching this one, I'm like, oh, I see.
Yeah, he's so... How would I describe his energy? Chaotic.
Yeah, I was about to say chaotic. But in like this, in extremely like rep theatre way, right? Like... he's been in the rep and he's done pantomime and you can feel it. I don't even know if he has done pantomime, but he has the energy of someone who has. You can always imagine him shouting, he's behind you. Oh no, he isn't. Sorry, I miss panto. I want to watch a panto, apparently.
Interestingly enough, Tom Baker did a panto in the 81-82 season of Treasure Island.
Oh, was he Long John Silver?
I found a audio version done by Big Finish of Treasure Island, okay, where he's both Silver and Flint.
Is this problematic for you particularly?
No, I think it's quite funny. I might get this audiobook. Okay, now I need to find out who he played in the pantomime. He played Long John Silver.
Excellent. I thought he would have.
There we go.
But yeah, I like a lot of the stuff he gets to say, which I guess is down to Douglas Adams, but like how paralyzingly dull, boring, and tedious. And you're like, yes, fantastic. I will be using this as something I just say constantly in my life. He breaks the fourth wall at one point, which is like, what? Mental. Yep.
It's something that probably would only happen in an Adams script as well.
Because obviously William Hartnell ad-libbed a fourth wall break in the 1960s, but I think that by this point, this show, while not being self-serious necessarily, had decided that it had a formula and it would be sticking to it. So Douglas Adams kind of shakes that up a tiny bit by introducing enough comedy.
Also, I imagine fourth wall breaks... Oops, sorry. I imagine fourth wall breaks happened differently with the sort of media culture, people had a very different relationship to the media they were consuming in the late 70s than they did in the late 60s, I think.
Yeah. Sorry, I've just Googled fourth wall break list to see, because I know that they did it in like Dick Van Dyke Show and stuff, especially in the 50s, because it was sitcoms that were advertising things in the middle in America, although I don't know how they did that when they rebroadcast them in the UK, or indeed if they did. I don't know how syndicated television worked in the 1950s. I'm sorry, everybody.
Syndication didn't really become a thing until the 70s, because there just weren't enough channels on in the first
place. But we know that they were selling Doctor Who internationally, so I have to assume that they were selling
syndication rights.
There's
as well.
the American cowboy show. What the fuck is that called?
Dallas?
No. Oh my god, what's it called?
The Westerner?
No, hang on.
The Range Rider, the Virginian, Cheyenne. Gunsmoke.
Gunsmoke and Bonanza. Although Gunsmoke. Bonanza, I think, is newer than that.
Yeah, Bonanza was 59. Gunsmoke was 55.
There you go.
And ran for 20 seasons. Fuck.
I knew that it was in there somewhere. It was in there somewhere. God.
Okay, let's finish the Doctor bit and then I have some more Doctor Who trivia to drop
That's
on
excellent.
You.
That's excellent. But yeah, you've had this point about his emotive arc in the serial, and we sort of discussed it already, but it's so fascinating seeing him as he learns more and realizes more about the reality of what has happened to Calufrex. He's still being his himself, but he's getting more and more like, well, this needs to end.
Yeah, it's very much that steady, there's not a sudden shift of it, but it's the steady movement from whimsy to fury, and how even the fury is tempered in a way that will be acceptable to the people he wants to manipulate or influence. I think it's really interesting. Would have loved that if that was like Four's overall arc, but I guess he stayed for a very long time.
It's difficult to say, because obviously like any arc that occurred was more to do with like natural progression in character rather than deliberate planning from 1975 to 1974 to 81, is it? Something like that.
Yep.
God, if that's right.
It's quite a long run. Something like that. Can we find out?
Almost definitely, simply by Googling it, but I won't.
Okay, 74 to 81.
Hey!
Good job.
I'm so good at Doctor Who. It could be my job.
I've got a trivia question for you. Which classic Doctor has performed in the most pantomimes?
Colin Baker.
Damn.
Is it Colin Baker?
In quite a fucking way. He seems to do it every bloody year.
I knew it. Immediately I was
he's played Captain Hook a lot.
I was immediately like, man does panto. He did the ultimate adventure. He will do panto every year.
And who do you think has done the least panto?
Patrick Troughton.
Yep, he did no panto at all. Everyone else did at least one.
Oh my god, I'm so good at this. I was thinking about it. I was like, he was a character actor in film after he left Doctor Who. So why would he do panto when he could go and be in The Omen? Like, I'm not saying that panto is inferior to The Omen. I'm just saying he was on a different career path.
I was sort of expecting Sylvester McCoy to have done a bit more because he's such a comedic actor. But then again, so is Colin Baker.
I guess it's tricky to...
And he has presence.
I think it's tricky to cast him in a particular role in a panto, Sylvester McCoy. Because he's not really like... Yeah. He's not really like a Widow Twankey type.
No.
And...
He could do, like, evil wizard
Yeah,
type.
I guess he could. the most recent panto I saw was, when I was on a student in second year, they took the entire school to see Aladdin at the Bristol Hippodrome. And there was an extended scene in which the joke was that the villain, who was played by a member of Wet Wet Wet, pronounced situation as shituation. And Joe Pasquale was going from one end of the stage to the other, repeating this long sentence that ended with the word, "We've got a real shituation." And obviously all of the children were in fucking hysterics. All the teachers were like, "Why have they done this? The schools are in today." Like, it was an all schools, an all school children audience.
Oh, God.
Why? Like, it was really fun, and there was a 3D segment, and the genie turned up and was a Bristolian. this massive
beautiful
puppet.
Course
it was really good, but also like, god, who came up with that? For one thing, who came up with casting the guy from Wet Wet Wet?
Probably the guy from Wet Wet Wet's agent,
but there you go, probably. Yeah.
All right, so that was our impromptu Panto Who.
That was
section.
My Panto review section, where I review the 2017 pantomime production of Aladdin at the Hippodrome.
I think we saw one of the Chuckle Brothers.
Oh my god!
That was when I was a wee child.
I remember once the Plymouth Pavilions. I didn't see it, but they had advertising up for one that was called like Dr. What and the Garlics, and it was a parody of Doctor Who, and I think the Chuckle Brothers were in it.
I think I saw
that. Oh my god!
I think I saw it. They toured it, and it came to the Grand Theatre in Wolverhampton, and I think I saw it.
And I reckon it was a touring when it was at the Plymouth Pavilion. Plymouth Pavilions is not a good theatre.
The Royal in Wolverhampton was nice, but I know far too many people who went to a show and had to evacuate because the fire alarm went off by accident.
I have to go.
Now look, if you're going to be in trouble, you'll need me to look after you.
Me too.
But you don't understand.
We can talk more about Romana One when we get to why we would marry her, but she is perfect. Oh my god.
She's so good.
Oh my god.
She's just got such authority.
It's true that the only way it would be better is if she was allowed to keep her Yorkshire accent, but other than that...
Yes. I think I read in a essay about this season that the entire like conflict between them is how can two egos that large fit in the same finite space. So good.
Perfect.
The other point that you've made that I really like is that she refers to herself as a Time Lord.
Yeah.
Rather than a Time Lady, and I think they should have stuck with that.
Let's roll it in with the gender segment. Why does it need to be gendered? They are Lords of Time. The Doctor always referred to the race as Time Lords in the past. Like, and we know also that Susan was, like, they wouldn't refer to her as a Time Lord, but clearly she was of the same, like, alien species as the Doctor, so she would also refer to as a Time Lord.
This
and then they
Lord.
Complicated it by going, well, actually, we have to have sexual dimorphism.
But do
they
you?
Don't. But it was being written by men in the 1970s. It should have, like, Councillor Flavia and stuff later on, like, she's clearly just a Time Lord. She has the same outfit as everyone else, and yet referred to as a Time Lady.
And
like, if it's a self-referential thing where it's like, Romana's like, I'm a Time Lady, Romana 2, and you're like, I get it because you're Romana 2 and you're like my beautiful special wife who I love. But Romana 1 is a Time Lord because she's like, you know, she's owning the power and the authority of it in a very cool way.
Yeah. And also sort of thinking forward to New Who, I think Missy's referred to as a Time Lady, but 13 hasn't been yet.
Yeah. I think it's interesting.
Which is interesting.
Missy, being called Missy, differentiated her from the Master, despite the fact that she is the Master.
Just call her the Master.
And I get that she's kind of differentiating herself from her previous incarnations, but she didn't have to. She didn't have to. And the actress is so, so good. Thank you, Michelle Gomez. And like, I need to listen to Missy, really, the audios, but I'm already saving up for The Lone Centurion and The Ninth Doctor Adventures and...
Do we want to jump back a little bit and talk about K-9, the bestest boy?
I've already screamed about how much I love K-9, but like, he's just, every episode we get to spend with him, I feel so blessed. I love that little dog.
He's such a delight. A good little boy.
He really is. I love when people don't notice him, even though he is about 3 feet long and 2 feet high.
And very insistent.
Yeah.
I love him.
Master! 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 Master!
So good. Very rude of the Doctor to keep ignoring him when he's trying to get the attention. Ugh. But yeah, K-9 is a very good companion.
Yes.
The world could do with more K-9.
I was very annoyed at someone referring to Chameleon as the Doctor's second worst robot companion, because I couldn't figure out who the worst one would be for ages, and then I was like, do they mean K-9?
That's a bad
people
take.
Hate K-9, and it's like, why do you hate Joy? Why do you hate man's best friend K-9?
Why would you choose to live like this when you can live any other way?
I have my K-9 t-shirt with me right now. Because
beautiful.
It says, Professor Marius presents the completely automatic K-9. Imagine your very own robot dog. Like, imagine your very own robot dog.
I'm imagining my very own robot dog and I want one.
I am constantly thinking about the fucking K-9 pattern in the pattern book and I need to do it. Maybe that can be your birthday present. We'll see how it goes.
Oh my god. I would love it.
Yes, it will be worth the 2.5 month delay or whatever it would be.
Time has no meaning anymore.
It really doesn't.
On your knees, Doctor.
The captain is
very gay.
It's such a perfect camp performance in every line. Like, to the level of, oh my god, I'm forgetting his name. The man in Horns of Nyman. Saldine.
My Saldine. Dreams of conquest!
Saldine in Horns of Nyman. Yeah, like, my dreams of conquest! Or like, the sky demon has betrayed me!
I really want the two of them to meet at like some support. a support group for people whose plans were foiled by the Doctor, and then
that
kiss.
Is a Doctor Who magazine backup comic in the making, mate.
And you're right about the vibes with him and Mr. Fibulee. Yeah. Very dedicated and devoted.
Indeed, it's gay. What can I say?
It's gay. Don't have much more to add.
Yeah, it's good because the Mr. Fibulee thing is like he's extremely. It's kind of a Burns and Smithers thing.
I don't quite read it like that. I think Fibulee's very dedicated, but he is sarcastic with his expressions.
Yeah,
of
I just mean
in a way that just tickles
me. In like the sense of one person demanding a lot from the other person, and the other person kind of doing it because they're in love.
It's
not romantic or anything. It's just when Fibulee dies and the captain goes fucking berserk, it's like, yes! Avenge your secret love. And as we've discussed, Fora and Isaac Newton having dinner. I'm doing air quotes, which is unhelpful on an audio podcast. it's just fun. Like, the whole conversation is so fun and like, and then he discovered gravity? No, I explained the whole gravity thing to him over dinner. He told me to get out of his tree.
Which, I love that as a meet cute.
Yeah, it's great. You just... And it makes more sense than discovering gravity because an apple bonked you on the head. That's just Concussion City, bud. You're on the Ian Chesterton train. I mentioned him. It's been an hour into the podcast and I did it.
Take that off your bingo
sheets. Absolutely. Rosie shoehorns Ian and or Barbara into the podcast.
Completely naturally.
Yeah. It's not like a super gay episode, but I do think it had like a fun vibe. It didn't have to be gay. Yeah. It just had a couple of bits where you... Oh, Prelix and Kimus. Prelix and Kimus. Yes, okay, best friends. Probably childhood best friends. Kimus is so worried about Prelix, he like rushes over and is like, oh no, he's been doing this so often. How are we going to protect him? Like, he's really dedicating himself
They're
to saving
in love.
Kimus. It's really sweet. And then we find out that Prelix is still pretty much himself despite being a Mentiad. And it's like, as soon as they sort all this out, I reckon Prelix and Mentiad are getting married. Like, I just think that's happening. And
I hope
Hula
so.
Is the,
I hope
Hula
they have
the
a really fancy psychic wedding. Yeah. It's also not like an overly heterosexual episode.
No,
either,
exactly. So. It's just kind of like people think that Ramona is hot. But women talk to her
Which,
as well.
Which, honestly,
so.
Same.
She is very hot.
Women probably think she's
yes,
hot too.
Yes, women do think she's hot. We're not women, but probably women do. But yeah. Speaking of women fighting Ramona hot.
Oh, sure. Lots of people.
And there's a woman!
A woman? Hey!
I would marry her in
I'm
a
I'm in
heartbeat.
The air car. Come beside me in the air car. We're going to drive the air car through the through the chroma keyed sky.
This is adorable.
As the skyline of Wife City appears on the horizon.
I never want to travel any
it's
other
so
way.
It's so fun. We didn't even mention the fucking corridors that shoot people out at the other end. Perfect.
Are gay. They have a little rainbow thing on them, therefore
like,
they're gay.
It shoots them all the way through and they go out the other end because of an inertial dampener. And at the very end, the Doctor and Ramona go through it. And then they stop. And then the Doctor's like, it would be terrible if I messed with this inertial dampener, wouldn't it? And then he just goes in and pulls something out. And the others just go, they just fly into the wall. Oh, gay thing. The guards' outfits.
Guards' outfits, definitely
BDSM
gay.
Shit. It's all studded leather. It's like Blake 7 once more. But like the Vengeance on Varos kind of BDSM situation.
Ooh,
I don't even know if it's the same outfits. It's very similar anyway.
They definitely have a lot in common.
Yeah, God. Anyway, sorry. Back to the wives.
Back to the wives. Ramona won. Big wife energy. she could pilot my TARDIS any day. Yes. Is that anything? Is there something there?
She can. Oh, hang on. What are the? Let's find some TARDIS terminology. She can
twiddle the knobs.
That wasn't what I was going for. She can. She can activate my multi-loop stabilizer.
She can fix my chameleon circuit.
Please. please. We need to check this. She can check my synchronic feedback checking circuit. God, okay. Other news.
Oh, my. I think she's great. I hope we're not objectifying her too much.
Yeah, I think that this segment is the place for saying this woman is very sexy. And also we find her sexy because she's so intelligent and can fly the TARDIS.
And so competent.
And I want to have dinner with her, and she can have red wine and I can drink something non-alcoholic because I hate wine, and we can exchange learned conversation.
Yeah. It's objectification, but not just objectification. Yes,
it's called fantasizing.
I just think she's very good, and I like that she is confident, and she just does shit. She has autonomy, and she doesn't think twice about using it.
She's so good. And, like the outfit is great. We've already mentioned this. It's like a pink satin blouse that goes, like, over... I was confused as to whether it was, like, a leotard or not. It's not a leotard. It's just a long, like, tunic shirt over a long-sleeved white shirt and trousers and white boots, as mentioned. And she's, like, hobbling around in these boots over the countryside. And you're like, they're not even... Like, it's not like a Joe Grant heel. It's not the highest heel in the world, but it's not a platform heel either, so it's definitely getting stuck in the mud.
Yeah, it's doesn't look comfortable.
Yeah, I can't imagine how long, like, the costume person just had to scrub the mud off every day. She's just great, and we've already discussed why we're in love with her. Like, it's Romana One. What do you want? She's like, she's beautiful and wonderful and haughty and
everything I could want in a space wife.
Yes, absolutely. I want her to get her own TARDIS, and then we can travel with her and have adventures.
Oh my god, can you imagine?
Like, canon divergence. She doesn't regenerate into Romana Two. She just fucks off. She's like, well, our job is done. I'm going back to Gallifrey. And then Gallifrey rewards her with a TARDIS for being so good at getting the key to time.
Yep. And the actual Romana 2 is an imposter role. It's the master. Romana 2 is the master.
I thought we established it was Iraj, the TARDIS herself. Yeah. Our other wives, we have Moola, who is very girl next door vibes, as you say. She is Prelix's sister. She's very worried about him. I just put her in because she seemed very confident. She was on, like, you know, asserting herself. She went and she goes and does stuff.
And she kept saying, no, I know what I want to do. I want to save Prelix.
I just remembered another Romana One thing is that she uses a blaster and, like, accurately shoots a guy, which is a very Trillian thing of her to do, I think. She had Trillian vibes this episode.
Absolutely.
Which is probably,
just shoots
I was
a
probably
guy.
Partly on that because I knew it was Douglas Adams, but, like, there's all the architecture there.
Yes. So Romana One is, like, the person I'd be too intimidated to talk to, whereas Moola, I would be like, okay, this is less intimidating. This is easier.
Should be a very pleasant date. And then we have Zanzia, evil wife.
I'm not usually one for evil wives, but definitely get it.
Yeah, she's just
very in control of the situation.
I can't quite describe it, but she's like just this supremely confident in her own abilities. Like, she knows who she is and what she's up to, and she's clearly got experience as like a hundreds of year old despot of this planet. Like, she's got this plan, and it wouldn't succeed because of the accelerating power requirements, but she did manage to maintain her plan for a very long time and manipulate all the people around her. And it's like, it wouldn't be good to be married to her, but she is very beautiful.
I wonder if they were trying to set up, like, Zanzia and Captain vibes, but did not work because the amount of camp in the Captain's performance.
I don't know that they were, because it feels more like she's deliberately framed as, like, just a carer, right? Because he's depicted as being extremely unbalanced, and she's there like, no, we need to calm down and do this. So you see her as, like, a stabilizing and sensible force, and then it turns out that the whole time she's been an evil empress, and you're like, yes!
Which is probably one of my favourite tropes. Women were secretly powerful all along.
It's very good.
Today's science fiction so often becomes tomorrow's science fact.
The Pirate Planet was first broadcast in end of September and October 1978. So a lot of the tone of this arc was responding to the BBC's desire to make the story more accessible and less gothic than Baker's earlier seasons. Personally, I adore it when Doctor Who goes gothic, and oh my god, there's some stuff in Leela that's very gothic that I can't wait for us to watch. But this is kind of a fun, almost genre riff pirates are a genre, but I don't think they hit most of the temples of the piracy genre.
It absolutely is a genre, you are correct.
Yep, but they're using it for aesthetic rather than for...
Thematic.
Yeah, definitely. Apparently Mr. Filbury was loosely based on Mr. Bones from Treasure Island, and the BBC archive also compares him to Peter Pan's
Which
Mr.
I guess
Smee.
Makes the captain Hook or... Long John Silver.
Yes.
Or possibly Flint.
He makes
guess,
much but... more sense as a Hook.
Yeah, more sense as a Hook.
No, I don't. I think he's got
he's
Hook
definitely
vibe. He's
got
that
Flint
very
vibe
camp...
based on what you're about to talk about.
Yeah, there's also like a bit in Peter Pan before I get onto my bullshit. In Peter Pan, there's very much like a Hook's tragic downfall in his own
hubris.
Confident, yeah, his own hubris that fits with this character as well. My next note is AIM takes 15 minutes to talk about Black Sails and how adapting classic stories is a brilliant way to subvert expectations and queer parts of the text, though most of the queerness in this story comes from the captain's campness.
Black Sails.
I'm very into Black Sails at
Please
the moment.
Please give us an elevator pitch for Black Sails.
Black Sails. Imagine if you heard the words produced around the same time as Game of Thrones, produced by Michael Bay, pirates, and after 3 episodes, it decides it actually wants to be a work of literary masterpiece and genius and breaks your heart time and time again. It's really good, very gritty, lots of, it's sort of like a political show more than anything else. It's about who owns power and how power works with some fascinating character dynamics. It's a prequel to Treasure Island.
Yes. It's about her empire, very bad.
Yeah, empire, very bad. And it's one of the best TV shows, like, end to end I've seen. Highly recommend it. Was very much hoping there'd be more actual pirate shit in this story so I could talk more about Black Sails. But alas, I just have the aesthetic. Piracy is often about empire and power, and there are themes of that in this story, but I think it comes at it from a bit of a more contemporary perspective rather than using piracy as a lens to tell that story.
Yeah, it's more about... We'll get to this in critique and discussing the themes. It's more about capitalism and environmentalism. Yep. Various other things.
Yep. Why you can't destroy whole planets.
Back to behind the scenes segment.
That was our pirate tangent. If you want to talk more about pirates, then please hit me up on Twitter. I will
absolutely do.
Keep going. This episode ties into the arcs, the Key to Time arcs theme of balance, noticeably with Queen Zanzia's suspension and the last few seconds of her life and the captain's trophy room. But there's a sort of implied criticism here of the idea that balance is inherently a moral good, which is interesting, especially when in the previous episode it introduced the White Guardian, the Black Guardian, in that sort of black and white morality.
Although we immediately were like, well, we don't like the White Guardian either because he's literally just a colonial
Evidently
stereotype.
A colonialist. And on this show, we don't like colonialism.
We definitely do not. And many of the writers of Doctor Who also don't like it. But no, I think we can talk more about that in the critique section. But it is interesting about the idea of balance being criticised, especially just compared to like other areas of reality. We'd be like, oh, well, you need to hear both sides. And in this case, it's like, well, one side is crushing planets to smithereens. So we don't need balance.
Yeah, if you hear both sides and still can't decide when one is actively causing harm, check yourself, please. So Douglas Adams' original outline involved a planet which is being mined by the Time Lords, who use a giant aggression-sapping machine disguised as a statue to pacify the natives. A Time Lord stuck in the slow time field in the midst of his last regeneration is sent to disconnect the machine, but becomes trapped in the works and absorbs all the aggression, inducing him to turn against his people. He causes the mining device to hollow out the planet and now plans to make it dematerialize and reform around Gallifrey, which... kind of love it.
Yeah.
Sort of love any story that's about Time Lords bad, actually.
Yeah. I find it interesting. Also, the stuff about slow time fields and stuff. Like, time fields, clearly Return and City of Death. Douglas Adams is a big fan of the localised time eddy.
Oh my god.
I do think Can't giant aggression sapping machine disguised as a statue is like proto Melka also.
Oh, I thought you were going to say proto the priorities of the British police force in 2021.
We can't get too topical.
Because it's going to go on months and months after.
But no, that is really interesting. I do understand why they changed it, though, because I think it would show, it would be a confusing shift in the motivation of the Time Lords as shown up to that point, in the sense that, like, the Time Lords, or, like, the Guardian of Time has sent them to do this task, and now the Time Lords have shown up, and they shouldn't really inform the Time Lords about the quest for the key to time, I think is the idea, right? So it's possible this was before they came up with the key to time thing that we're going to do this. And yeah.
It feels like it was pretty good. I think it would be a good idea. And I kind of think that would have been a better story because the key to time thing is such a minuscule part of the plot.
Yeah. I did notice they got to the end of episode 4, they hadn't even held the key to time segment. They were just like, yeah, we'll go and pick it up. And then it ended. And I was like, what?
Okay, cool.
And then there's your one last thing.
Adams wanted to give the parrot the line, pieces
of silicate.
Fucking love. Fucking love it.
It's very good.
I wish he'd done it.
The parrot barely talks. And it's like, come on. You've made this little robot parrot. Voice it.
It does fly, yes, and it's very cute.
It's very good.
Now we'll all go, except Miss Shaw.
Oh, just a minute. I'm not going to miss all
No, Miss Shaw.
Have you never heard of female emancipation?
Liz, this time I think he's right.
The fucking CSO effect in the last episode, where the Mentiad and Four are doing their telepathy thing, and they project themselves into the engine room. They pick up a spanner from the floor with telepathic powers, telekinetic powers, and they float it over to this piece of machinery. And the Mentiads are like, what do we do with it now? Four is just like, hit it! So they go bonk, and it explodes. Perfect.
It's fucking brilliant.
Perfect. Because, like, the first piece of critique that I saw of this episode was when I went to log the serial on Letterboxd. And the top review for it is 2 stars. And the 2-star review is, let me find it, because, you know, we can rip it to shreds. Disappointed with this one. The ambitions of Douglas Adams' writing here just didn't fit well enough into the show's budget, and unfortunately it detracts from the overall experience. There are some fun moments, and part 4 of the story brings a really good pace to it, but it can't help but feel restricted by some very outdated effects. Someone doesn't know how to have fun.
The effects are never bad in Doctor
Who. No, they're fantastic. They're excellent. They're good. Like, Big Snake.
It's part of the fun. Oh God, Big Snake.
We really went with Big Snake.
We all know we love Big Snake.
Everyone knows we love Big Snake. We definitely recorded that episode last week and not like a month ago. But yeah, I just think that the effects really lend itself to the campness of the serial. Like,
It's not even trying to be anything it's not, which is why Doctor Who old effects sort of last in a way.
I think it leans...
It's not overly
ambitious.
It lends
itself well to Douglas Adams' sense of humour as well, because it all feels very deliberate in its kind of artificiality.
Jankiness.
There you go.
That's a good way to put it.
There's probably a better word, but I thought that was a little bit of a weak criticism of the episode to go, this is only 2 stars because the effects are bad, and it's like, my dude... Do you go and watch?
You're watching
Classic
Who.
Do you go and watch a play and go, well, I wasn't convinced that I was really in medieval England, so 2 stars. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Takes a lot of the joy out of it.
Yeah, like if they had £1 million an episode and it looked like this, I'd go, where's the money going? But they didn't, so
they did pretty well. It went over budget. One of the ones that was had production errors and definitely cost more produce than they wanted it to, but.
All right, next point. Capitalism Bad, an essay by Douglas Adams.
Capitalism Bad. yeah, that's it. That's the...
Yeah. I'm going to try and find that quote from Hitchhikers about money. About green pieces of paper.
I mean, it's an interesting way for the show where the Doctor, not being somebody who tends to use currency... engages it with it like this, but the capital is very much an entire planet and how you can commodify all of that to increase your gains effectively, which is why I think it's not actually a pirate story, because pirate stories also say capitalism bad, socialism good. They would have very democratic crews and everyone would get equal shares of the profit, with a few members of the crew getting slightly more. You could vote the captain out.
Yeah, you could get
gay
married,
trying to escape a capitalism. Yeah. That's what the term Métis is short for, the longer threat word meaning what pirate marriage was effectively.
Which word?
And if you're, oh my god, I think it's Métis.
Oh yeah, Métis, whatever.
Métis.
Something like that.
Yeah. Yep. And if your pirate husband died, then the pirate widower would get that share of the treasure from that raid. So yeah, it was very communal. It was very much taking care of each other.
Yes, I have found the quote from Douglas Adams about money. This is from the forward to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Far out in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy lies a small, unregarded yellow sun. Orbiting this at a distance of roughly 92 million miles is an utterly insignificant little blue-green planet whose ape-descended life forms are so amazingly primitive that they still think digital watches are a pretty neat idea. This planet has, or rather had, a problem, which was this. Most of the people living on it were unhappy for pretty much all of the time. Many solutions were suggested for this problem, but most of these were largely concerned with the movements of small green pieces of paper, which is odd because on the whole it wasn't the small green pieces of paper that were unhappy. And so the problem remained. Lots of the people were mean, and most of them were miserable, even the ones with digital watches. Many were increasingly of the opinion that they'd all made a big mistake in coming down from the trees in the first place, and some said that even the trees had been a bad move and that no one should ever have left the oceans. And then one Thursday, nearly 2,000 years after one man had been nailed to a tree for saying how great it would be to be nice to people for a change, a girl sitting on her own in a small cafe in Rickmansworth suddenly realised what it was that had been going wrong all this time, and she finally knew how the world could be made a good and happy place. This time it was right, it would work, and no one would have to get nailed to anything. Sadly, however, before she could get to a phone to tell anyone about it, a terrible, stupid catastrophe occurred, and the idea was lost forever.
I fucking love Douglas Adams' style.
It's so good! And, like, this movement of small green pieces of paper is such a damning indictment of the fact that money doesn't mean anything. We've constructed this value for currency.
It is fake.
It's fake.
Yeah. It was created by the people who could give themselves a lot of it easily.
Yeah. The subheading to this essay is, of course, The Industrial Revolution, A Bad Idea by Douglas Adams, and Fracking is Also Bad, also by Douglas Adams. You've got a note here about this.
Yeah, he was famous. Douglas Adams was famously an early advocate for conservation and using technology to learn more about the environment, so this really fits in it. There's a great little article in the Salmon of Doubt anthology, which is the first few chapters of the Dirk Gently novel, Salmon of Delt, and then sort of an anthology of his non-fiction writing as well. So worth checking out. It's really fun and interesting to read, but he talks about going in an early, like, conservation-based submarine to see turtles.
That is so cool.
I think it was turtles. It's just wonderful. Really recommend checking that out, especially if you want to know more about the values that definitely informed a lot of Adams's writing.
Yes. I don't really have any critique of...
I got a copy in a charity shop.
I don't really have any critique of this element of the story, because, like, it's just a theme that appears in it. Like, the fact that you shouldn't mine another planet for resources, even if it is uninhabited, and destroy it, because it is a planet that exists, and you shouldn't destroy it. And then they try and destroy Earth, and the Doctor's like, you can't destroy Earth, it's inhabited. Can't destroy a planet that's inhabited, especially if you live on it.
Is it an effective... Does it effectively get across its thesis of capitalism bad, or is it too subtle? Could it be?
I think it muddies
explained
it.
Explained away as individuals do bad rather than systems do
bad. I think it muddies it by having the pirate guy be an insane cyborg, which, for one thing, we don't really like the dehumanization of the disabled, generally speaking, in stories. No,
or, like, disrespectful portrayals of mentally ill people as well.
It's very late 70s, like, despot, tyrannical ruler kind of thing. But the actor goes so ham with it that it ends up feeling like something is seriously wrong with this man. Which is, you know, just get him some help, man. Not Zanzia as a secretly not a nurse. I don't know.
Yep.
And it's not really a theme that persists in Adam's writing, so I think this is probably more of a one-off thing. But, yeah. Don't return to the trope, is what I'm saying.
Yep. Yeah, I'd agree with you that it's muddied, and I think because the ending is so rushed in a way, it works as a story, it doesn't work as making a point.
Yes.
Which is fine, Doctor Who does not always have to be deep or full of allegory.
Not all sci-fi has to make a point, it's just nice when it does.
Yeah, it's. I think it's frustrating because it starts to make a point and it doesn't follow through. I think that's probably the only issue I'd have with it.
Yeah.
A for effort, could have done more.
Let me get this straight. A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard, it can move anywhere in time and space.
Yes. Quite so.
But that's ridiculous.
Here's all my notes on the EU this week. Don't have the brain for a short trip. I think I'll talk about Hitchhiker's Guide instead. So,
Please do.
Without further ado, here are some links between Hitchhiker's Guide and Doctor Who, beyond the fact that Douglas Adams wrote for both and the references we've already talked about. For example, in this serial, the Doctor says, "Don't panic!" Which is useful. The Doctor is definitely a real Hoopy Frood who knows where his towel is. We also have, the Seventh Doctor once asked rhetorically who had said that Earthmen rarely invite their ancestors to the dinner, which came from the series. The Master asks a near-identical question, albeit with different wording, when attempting to recover his TARDIS alongside River Song on Cheska Minor. So that's from an audio. The number 42 was one of the numbers the 10th Doctor guessed when trying to find out the security protocol for the host in Voyage of the Damned. Another fact about Voyage of the Damned is that Douglas Adams, in 1998, I think, published an adventure game that had a similar plot in the sense that it was about, you know, that in Hitchhikers, there's the space Titanic that sinks essentially before it has the chance to leave the dock. It was unable to send out its first and only message in SOS during its launch before suffering a total existence failure. It's a fun one.
Yeah.
It's a fun one.
That's very Adamsian.
There are some more. When the Doctor is pointing out species to Clara in the Rings of Akatan, one of the species is the Hulavu, who are from Hitchhikers. When the Fourth Doctor speaks to the Hornets, he mentions the Vogons, and we all know about Vogon poetry. Last year, when I was teaching, I went to World Book Day as Arthur Dent, and I told the kids about this. And then when we were doing remote learning, one of the kids had posted something on his journal and was like, "Can you show Miss French this, please?" And it was a book report about Hitchhiker's Guide. And he's in year two. He'd read it with his dad, and he said his favorite part was the Vogon poetry. And I was like, "Oh my god, that's a little nerd!"
Beautiful.
So shout out to him. I hope he's doing well and watching and reading more sci-fi. It was very sweet.
Yes, good to know that the next generation of nerds are. So
that was around
sweet.
The age I was when my parents started putting on the cassette tapes of the radio play. And we all amazing. Developed a dance to the tune. Da 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 da.
Cute.
Da 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 da. It goes on. It's very good, the radio play. It's just, The Hitchhiker's Guide is just fucking good. Everyone should read it. It's iconic. It's iconic science fiction.
It's formative.
For a reason. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's also very easy to read.
Yeah, it's just enjoyable.
It just glides.
I should note, Hitchhiker's Guide is actually technically four books, and then there's an extra one by Owen Colfer that I haven't read.
It's a trilogy in four parts.
So there's Hitchhiker's Guide, and then Restaurant at the End of the Universe, and then some other ones. And it's great. Arthur Dent and Zaphod Beeblebrox are seen imprisoned in the webcast version of Sharda. And then obviously in The Christmas Invasion, when Ten is in pyjamas, he says that he met Arthur Dent, or he knows that Arthur Dent was a lovely, nice man who got the Earth, who saved the Earth for a bit. As mentioned in our Destiny of the Daleks episode, they mentioned Ulan Khaluford, who wrote a number of books. I still haven't found out if he's the one who proves that black is white, because I haven't read Hitchhikers in a while. There are... obviously Professor Chronotis, who was in Shadow, went on to be in Dirk Gently, the books, not in the TV series, although who knows what would have happened in season 3, because there were supposed to be aliens. Peter Davison was in the 1981 adaptation of Hitchhikers as Dish of the Day, and
perfect.
His wife at the time played Trillian.
We
love Trillian. She's just great. Short for Trisha McMillan, but Zaphod Beeblebrox decided that it wasn't spacey enough. The third Hitchhiker's book was based on a rejected Doctor Who script called Doctor Who and the Cricket Men, and it was novelised by James Goss later on, which I really want to read, because I think that's the tertiary, or whatever it's called, volume of the radio play is the Cricket Men, and there's a bit where they materialise in Lords, and there's a bit where they're in a cave, and Arthur has a Scrabble bag full of Scrabble tiles, and he's like, "Well, surely, based on infinite improbability, whatever Scrabble tiles I pull out of this bag will tell me what I need to ask." And he keeps pulling out these tiles, and it ends up with, "What is 6 multiplied by 7? I don't know how I remember these things in such detail. We just listened to them so many times. There's a lot of other minor references, and it's unclear, based on the ever-changing landscape of Doctor Who canon, whether Hitchhiker's Guide is canon as an event within Doctor Who or as a fictionalized property within Doctor Who, or potentially both.
Probably both. Both feels
about right. On the
website,
who is Doctor Who? Arthur Dent says that the Ninth Doctor lay down in front of a bulldozer in front of his house, calling him rather odd. There's a lot of very fun ones. Two references in the Pirate Planet. Mandronite 1-5, which is one of the minerals that's mentioned in this, also mentioned in Hitchhikers. And I also I googled Hitchhiker's Guide to Doctor Who links. And one of the things I found was a fan page for the guy who played Ford Prefect in the TV series called...
Yes, I love the internet. Of
called David Dixon hyphen the dictionary hyphen unofficial fan page, which is, hasn't been updated in a really long time, but it's so charming. Like, apparently he was in Zed Cars once. There was a live journal site just for all of them. Ugh. Like, it's just... so charming in its own way. The last update of the website was in 2010, so who knows what's going on there. But we have David Dixon links, other David Dixon things, and gallery. There's some fan art. There's some manips.
Nice.
There's some photos of him in various roles. Like, I don't know if he was any good as Ford Prefect. I still haven't seen the show. I've seen the movie, obviously, with Martin Freeman and, oh God, what's the name of the actor who plays Ford?
Alan Rickman.
No, I know Alan Rickman plays Marvin, and the design of Marvin in those movies is perfect.
Who played Zaphod Beetlebrox in that movie?
I meant Ford Prefect.
I thought it was Mos Def as Ford Prefect.
Zaphod Beetlebrox was like fucking Owen Wilson or something.
Sam Rockwell.
There you go. I
also heard Bill Nighy as Slurty Belfast.
Yes, I was thinking about that. He's really good in it. Zaphod Beeblebrox, in the TV show, the two heads are next to each other and look insane. And
that's how I always imagined
it.
Exactly.
In the book, it's clearly that. And then in the film, his head goes up and there's another face on his neck, which is horrifying. And
yeah,
surely in 2005 weird. They could have CGI'd another head onto this guy's neck. Like, surely.
Yeah.
Just build out the shoulder a bit wider. Have the third arm underneath. Zaphod is such a crazy character. Also, Stephen Fry narrated the 2005 film. And it's an underrated film, I think, in the sense that everyone whines that it's not much like the book. And it's like, the whole point of every adaptation of Douglas Adams' work is that he changed it.
Have you ever tried to adapt Adams? Like, so much of his genius is the way that he plays with language and words.
Like, the...
you have to accept that you can't put that onto the screen without
like, the
being
Dirk
clumsy.
Gently TV show that we both love so much, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, is barely based on the books.
It feels like...
But it...
Yeah, but it feels like it. It has the same experience emotionally,
it feels
though...
Adamsian, because it's got, like, electric ghost rhinos and, like, you know, alternate bubble dimensions with bleeding tables and it's, you know...
It's
all feels
brilliant.
Like his kind of thing, and it's very good.
Something about the way that it's Sam, what's his name?
Samuel Barnett.
He plays Dirk. Samuel Barnett, yes. He's just so earnest and
he's
joyful
so
in a way that just feels Adamsian.
I will cry.
Also Elijah Wood as his effectively companion. So your recommendations from this episode are Black Sails and the Netflix
version. And just Hitchhiker's Guide in any format that you can get it. Like, play the adventure game,
but use a walkthrough.
Because if you forget that fucking screwdriver or toothbrush in the pocket of the dressing gown, then you're fucked. Like, every time I've tried to play it, I've been following a walkthrough and I've died. And I'm like, why can't I put the thing in the plug on the wall? Oh my god. It's like when we were trying to play the Discworld adventure game as kids and we had a walkthrough, but the walkthrough had different names for the objects and we were like, well, this is useless. Discworld is also very good. Just as a note.
Discworld, we'll have to find a way to do a Discworld segment at some point.
Yeah.
It's our podcast, we can talk about things we
god,
love.
God, imagine if they'd... I imagine Rihanna Pratchett's probably on the list of gets for episodes of Doctor Who, right? Like, she's got to be on the list of guests.
I mean, Doctor Who didn't have a female writer leading on an episode until like
the last season. It's been bad. Like they
this
had
is bad.
They, fucking oh my god, what's her name? Jacqueline. Someone wrote Daleks in Manhattan. Daleks in What's her fucking name?
And they have had.
It's probably not even Jacqueline something. Helen Rayner. Helen Rayner. Jacqueline something else. I knew it was Rayner, and then I was like, who's Jacqueline Rayner? And then I was like, she does short trips.
Probably.
She does short trips. Helen Rayner.
But even then, that was 2007, yeah. Okay.
But they I don't think they ever had one in the classic series.
No. At least in New Who, there's always been a woman as an executive producer.
Hang on, okay. She was the first woman to write for the new series, as well as the first woman to write a Dalek story in Doctor Who's history. Hang on.
Who was... Okay.
I'm cutting all of this for the record. Leslie Scott was the first woman to be credited as a writer on a Doctor Who story, but Clegg is the first woman to actually write a story for the programme. Clegg. Enlightenment!
Okay. Okay. Interesting.
But there you go. Facts.
And there have been very few women writing for Doctor Who.
We've got...
And it shows. It definitely does show.
We adore the show. Oh my god. It needs more women.
I think that's just an experience of being a member of any marginalisation in the science fiction community.
Yeah.
Like... You can love it whilst expecting it not to...
be good.
I guess not even be good, not to meet those standards. Because art can still be good and impactful whilst being problematic. The two are not mutually exclusive.
Sorry, I've just found that John Lucarotti, who wrote Marco Polo, also wrote The Ark in Space, and then Robert Holmes completely rewrote it. And it's like... I want to know what it was like. I want to know what Doctor Who Alien was like before it became Alien but Doctor Who. Especially by the guy who wrote exclusively historicals.
Also, completely unrelated, tragic that Rob Shearman hasn't written another episode since Dalek. Yeah,
definitely.
I know he does lots of stuff for Extended Universe, but...
Oh, also, a woman wrote Survival.
Ooh! Okay,
and she
that
wrote
shows.
The Eaters of Light for the new series.
Which one was The Eaters of Light?
So season 10.
Oh, it's the Scottish one with What's-Her-Face from The
Thing. I don't know. I haven't seen it.
I vaguely recall it.
Oh, yeah. Leslie Scott had writing credit on The Ark, but apparently didn't actually write any of the script. And I'm desperate to know why she had writing credit if she didn't write any of the script.
Often it's like story credit. I think they've got better in like modern shows at separating story credit from teleplay. So if you come up with the story and the plot and the beats, that's technically still part of the writing process.
But there we are. Okay. Back to what we were talking about, which is, I think, we need to move on to rankings. Oh, actually, I just wanted to say, I've been reading The Minute Cuckoos this week. Fucking mental book. Why is... I'm 100 pages in and the alien babies have not even been born. This is the book that Village of the Damned is based on, where the only thing you know is that there's creepy children in it.
Okay.
And there's no creepy children yet.
I've been listening to Catherine Janeway's autobiography, read by Kate Mulgrew, and it's so lovely, and it's,
nice.
Recommended. Nice. Watch Voyager first.
Yeah.
Anyway. If we're doing Rex, then.
Okay, rankings.
It's not a Star Trek
podcast. Do you have an X of the week?
My X of the week has to be the sweet mix-up of the week where the Doctor references jelly babies and he throws them and they are clearly licorice all sorts.
This is a translation circuit error, actually. The first time the Doctor was introduced to Earth Sweets was like Susan brought home a big bag of jelly babies. And ever since then, he's just assumed that jelly babies is the collective term for sweets in English.
I love it. I love it very much. What about you?
My X of the week is... My X of the week is transportation method of the week for the fucking inertia corridor. Insane.
Yes, good
I want to go in one. Like, you don't have to run down the corridor anymore. The corridor runs you. Like,
it looks quite unnerving.
It's very good. If you have your own X of the week, please tweet us at PolarityPod. We really do want to know. It's X of the week is anything that is in the episode that you liked the most.
Or tangentially related to it.
And then we move on to... which sounds kind of like a carnival theme when you sing it that fast. So Bruce Purchase, who played the captain, unsurprisingly was in Blake 7. based on his whole vibe. He played Gola in season 2, episode 12, The Keeper, which I've not watched. This was extremely easy to find out, so I don't have much material for Blake 7 connections this week. I did think that the costumes for the guards were very Blake 7. And Blake 7 would start filming the following year. So based on the doctor, based on the communal BBC wardrobe department, something's going on
here.
They're starting to filter things that will become Terry Nation's playground. But yeah.
A friend of the show.
Friend of the show, friend of the podcast, Terry Nation, our best friend, our buddy, our pal. And speaking of the show, that wasn't a very good segue. So now we rank the serial out of 5. 5 whatever you likes. What do you think, Aime?
I'd probably give it a 3.5 rubies that are being used as pebbles.
That's
out of
fair.
5.
I would give it 4 air car joyrides out of 4. Out of 5, pardon me. Can't
nice.
Speak.
Nice.
I really, really liked
Where'd
it.
Where'd we put it overall?
Yeah. Let's have a look at the ranking. I just really liked having comedy that was actually funny. Like, yeah. Rather than, like, there's jokes in every Doctor Who episode, and they're quite good jokes, but they rarely do comedy as an overarching genre for a serial. I think this, for me, would go between Peladon and Seeds of Death.
That's exactly where I was hovering my mouth. I didn't want to click the cells so you wouldn't see where I was thinking it.
Because you know how much I love the Ice Warriors. You know.
I do.
Okay, so I did not read the novelization this week because I am taking the slow route because it's my birthday week. So I'm having time to myself to read the Minish Cuckoos. I am sure the novelization would be fine, but it wouldn't be written by Douglas Adams. So it was written by James Goss, who also novelised the Cricket Man thing. Oh, it was only published in 2017.
Yeah, because Adams reserved the rights to the novelisation.
And then he didn't do it, which is fair enough.
Well, that's because he passed away well before his time.
Extremely sad. And then, they've republished it this year, apparently. And there's a expanded version for the hardback edition that's based on the first draft scripts. One of the chapters is called Have You Ever Seen an Arcturian Mega Chicken?
I can't say I have.
The Doctor finds the key to time boring due to its 6 parts.
Oh boy. Where do we think it shows up in the magazine ranking?
I think 60. I don't think it'll be that high, but
I'm gonna go for around like 93.
I want it to be high, but I don't think it will be. 109. I mean, that's a decent ranking. It's like halfway. It's below the War Machines and above the Awakening. And also above the Seeds of Death.
Okay, not familiar with either of those. Which you would not agree with.
I would not
agree
with. The Seeds of Death is incredible, even though it's extremely long for no reason. Just get on the rocket and the rocket arrives on the moon. Why does it need to take a whole episode?
You're right.
I'm right and I should say it. Terrence Dix.
Oh,
Brian Hales was also involved.
He must spend so much of his time just like rolling around in his grave based on what they're saying.
It's good exercise, isn't it? Anyway.
Anyway.
Thank you very much for listening to Polarity Pod, a pirate Doctor Who podcast.
You can become some of our crew.
Find us on Twitter at PolarityPod or on Tumblr at polaritypod.tumblr.com. And we'll see you or hear from you next time when we cover the Claws of Axos.
Aye, aye, Captain.
Hoist the mainsail.